Hello, this is the Westminster Standard. I'm Ryan Beasy. Welcome to the program. At its 50th General Assembly, the Presbyterian Church in America empowered the moderator, Mr. Fred Greco, to appoint a commission that would write a letter to many civil leaders to humbly petition them for the protection of children from the dangers of gender reassignment surgery. And today I am joined by Teaching Elder Nathan Newman, the chairman of that commission, which has finished its work and sent the letter it has drafted on our behalf to the leaders of the federal government. Well, Nathan, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Ryan.
My pleasure. So, Nathan, tell me a little about yourself. You work with Ministry to State on Capitol Hill, and I thought the federal government didn't have anything to do with states. What do you do in Ministry to State?
That's a great question.
Is D.C. A state now?
D.C. is not yet a state. Taxation without representation is still our motto on the back of all of our license plates. But I have been privileged to serve as a minister here in the D.C. area for about a decade. I served on the pastoral staff of McLean Presbyterian Church for 9 years, and then about a year and a half ago, joined Ministry to State. My family and I have always lived on Capitol Hill. My wife, Jess, works for a senator, and we've lived here and built a strong community. And so when the opportunity came about a year and a half ago to join the Ministry to State team, I jumped on board and serve as a minister to members of Congress. So in many ways, serving as a chaplain and pastor to members and leaders in government.
Wonderful. How long did you say you've been doing that?
So just about a year and a half. Okay. I started in the 118th Congress, which began in January 2023.
Okay. And then before that, were you at McLean Pres? Is that what I...
That's right.
Did I read that properly? Okay. And what was your role there?
I had various roles, but served a lot with young adults, college, our senior saints, everywhere in between, military families. I'm also a reserve chaplain at Arlington National Cemetery, and ultimately finished my time there serving as the congregational care shepherding pastor.
Wonderful. Wonderful. When I was in high school, we made a trip to Arlington to dedicate a memorial, one of those granite bricks for folks who were killed in training exercises and peacekeeping missions. So that was a moving time. So your qualifications, obviously, in the connections that you have with the members of Congress in your role, how did you get in touch with moderator Fred Greco?
Yes, some of us volunteered for the commission. Some were more voluntold. And so, it's a really incredible group of men. They're all doctors, medical professionals, and theologians. And I was just there to get the virtual coffee for them all.
Great. Yeah, let's talk through this this all-star list of commissioners. Dr. Bruce Baugus from Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary, formerly of Reformed in Jackson. James Lopez, professor of pediatrics, not just a pediatrician, but a professor of pediatricians at the University of Michigan. I imagine he had some great passion for this work, given his the service he does with children. One of our Covenant College professors, Dr.
Go Scots.
I'm sorry?
Go Scots. I'm a Covenant grad myself.
Well, and we're pretty close to Covenant College here. Dr. Hans Mudweme, he is also a medical doctor, is he not?
That's right. He practiced medicine and went through a residency, went to Howard, did a residency at Mayo, but the Lord called him into ministry. And so he went on to TEDS directly after residency and got his divinity degree and now teaches Bible and theology at Covenant.
Great, great. So a valuable perspective. And then yourself and Dr. Blair Smith, another seminary faculty, academic dean at RTS. RTS Texas, I guess.
RTS in Charlotte, but he is also the dean at RTS Dallas in Houston. That's right.
Yes, yes. And he earned his theology from some little school called Harvard. Where is that? Is that... up in Boston somewhere. Okay. Yeah, I think I've heard of it. They have a rowing team or something.
That's right.
And Dr. Bill Whitaker, Third Prez in Alabama, another pediatric physician, 40 years experience, it says here.
So, yeah, and just a note about Bill, too. Bill was one of the original drafters of Overture 12 that came out of Evangel Presbytery. So he was a really crucial member of our commission as well as we were drafting this letter.
Outstanding. So do you have any other stories that you can tell about these men and their passion for the work, the ministry that they were assigned by our moderator?
Yeah, at least for me personally, I'd heard just about the difficulty in delivering these letters to the actual leaders themselves, to the right people. And we've had an opportunity just in the past decade or so developing relationships with people on Capitol Hill. I wanted to make sure that the people who we were actually petitioning actually received the humble petition. Mm. Yeah. Several of them are friends and acquaintances. And so that's where I hoped to be able to serve on the commission, is just being able to get this letter in the right hands. Dr. Whitaker has been fighting for life for Alabama for years. He actually testified as one of the pediatricians for the Alabama Vulnerable Child Compassion and Protection Act, which is one of the 22 state legislations that have been passed. Alabama's is still being litigated, but have been passed that really align with the PCA's letter, which is to keep these hormones, these medicines, these surgical interventions out of the conversation for children who are minors.
Right, right, yes. This is just, in my assessment, horrific and unprecedented, and we of course use that word a lot, but at least unprecedented in the last 500 years in the Western world, that these unspeakable things would be done to children. Well, there has been much criticism in the denomination, or at least some vocal criticism in my own presbytery, alleging that this sort of statement is inappropriate, that it will harm our ability to speak into various communities. Did the commission discuss whether this task was properly before them? Was there any discussion that, well, we've been assigned to do this, but can we do this task in keeping with our confessional standards?
Yeah, there were two questions that we all had to ask ourselves as elders at the 50th General Assembly. First is, does this constitute an extraordinary case? And I think there was pretty quick agreement that this is a case extraordinary that is worthy of our denomination's attention. The second question was, should we speak through the commission, as a rule? And the GA decided, and of course we were willing to serve on this commission, although I think we would all agree ordinarily we think this should come through the General Assembly itself. So we do understand the inherent danger in commissions, but we were willing to serve because it was the General Assembly's decision. But we absolutely, because of that, wanted to take all perspectives into account, including the speakers who are against the commission. And so we reached out to many of those folks as we began to meet, because we wanted to be very careful that we were representative of a broad spectrum across the PCA. And I hope we earned the denomination's trust. I think that there absolutely are legitimate concerns, but I think we've proved ourselves trustworthy. Although I do think we should be careful to set a precedent, perhaps only in cases extraordinary, we use this moment to speak in such a way.
Yes, and you refer to cases extraordinary, which is not just because you like to use fancy words, but that is the language of our Constitution, that synods and councils, Westminster Confession of Faith 31:4, are to handle or conclude nothing but that which is ecclesiastical, are not to intermeddle with civil affairs which concern the Commonwealth, unless by way of humble petition in cases extraordinary. And so I think that you tried to walk that narrow line very well. The assembly vote was somewhat close, at least by the 50th General Assembly standards, 58% voting in favor of establishing this commission, which was which would have been decisive in most other years, but for the 50th, with when almost everything was at least a two-thirds majority, including calling the question, I might add. So that certainly factored into how you crafted this statement. Now, why? Why? You know, I have my opinions, but no one's interested in my opinions. That's why they listen to this podcast, where I have people with informed opinions on. Why did the commission believe that this was a case extraordinary?
Yeah, the debate, as you know, was more on the way that this letter would be drafted. And I think at the assembly, we were tired. There were a lot of important things on the docket. And so the Overtures Committee decided to empower the moderator to appoint a commission. I was not a part of those discussions. But if we had not approved their recommendation, then this overture would have essentially been dead, which is why I think a majority thought it important enough to move forward and to trust the moderator to appoint a representative commission of the denomination. And so we were all in the same page. We don't believe that the PCA should be making public statements about every policy issue, but we collectively, because there was such, I think, unanimity around this being a case worthy of our attention, agreed and wanted to take this issue up.
Yes, I wondered as I was thinking about this, you know, there are some faith communions that are affirming of child mutilation. Is that something that you thought, well, you know, the PCA, as a representative of the true Church of the Lord Jesus Christ, one branch of his church, we need to speak clearly onto this issue that no, the church cannot support this, even if those bearing the name of church or Christian would celebrate such.
Yeah, a culture that is permitting of violence and abuse of children is the very definition of a case extraordinary in my book. And, you know, there were some, we certainly had discussions about even parental limits to these types of decisions for their children, because we agree that the state also has an interest in the welfare of children. That's why there's abuse or other harms to children. There are clear moral violations of the created order. And so the state doesn't interpret and apply scripture. That belongs to the church. And so that's why we thought it was appropriate for the church to be able to speak in on this very important topic.
Yes, yes. Now, on the other hand, right, there are those who have criticized the statement for not going far enough, that it only condemns gender reassignment as a whole. Why did you focus on the minors?
You know, we were really given a very direct task from the assembly itself, and so we were really leaning on that. So I think the assembly very rightly stated that we condemn the practice in general, but especially of minors. So it is broader than just minors, but the, you know, the rhetorical weight is certainly on minors, because we wanted to be careful that we're not speaking as public policy experts, but speaking as ministers of the word. The church is speaking as a minister of the word to the world. And so we wanted to speak very clearly on this issue, which is not just limited to minors. So I would say actually that it focuses on children, but generally as a whole, we see this practice as a violation of God's good design for gender and for sexuality.
Yes, yes. And as you know, you don't speak only about the practice with minors, but especially minor children, which is not to exclude any other category of person. But also, I think there's an important Presbyterian principle at play here, that Presbyterians ought to be very wary of commissions in general. And when a commission is created and appointed, that commission ought to be quite careful to address its mandate, and you did that, right? You weren't commissioned by the General Assembly to write a letter about gender mutilation, generally.
But we didn't talk about transgender sports, for example. There's a lot of places that we could have gone on this topic, but we're very intentionally trying to follow what the Assembly set up for us to go after.
Right. And I think the commission should be commended for that, because you, I mean, you could have developed a 300 page document if you wanted to. Yeah, that would have been very easy. But I think the commission wisely exercised restraint and chose to fulfill its mandate rather than that mission creep, which is so common in our culture.
Thank you.
You had a number of physicians, either practicing or retired or former practicing physicians. And as I understand, all physicians take the Hippocratic Oath. Would you, I know this isn't quite your area of expertise as a minister of the gospel, was there any discussion of whether the practice of gender reassignment, as it's called, violates the Hippocratic Oath, which is, of course, in substance, to do no harm?
Yeah, we certainly reference the original Hippocratic Oath, which included doing no violence to male and female bodies. And we did not appeal to that as a primary appeal. That's really, you know, in the New Testament way, a testimony of the nations, just an example of general revelation and how we see gender playing out in the world. And so for the practice of thousands of years, this has been the standard for healthcare. And even more recently, some of the health organizations that have offered gender-affirming care, as a rule, they say that children should not receive that type of gender-affirming care. Even they have said that is for the standard, for the general child, not what is to be recommended. And so we think that, you know, science agrees with that as well.
Yes, that's yeah, that's something that, you know, even in Europe, things are pulling back. This attack on the body is perhaps the most direct attack that Satan can make on the Imago Dei, the image of God. Why do you think this particular issue is so pronounced and prevalent in society right now? What is it about society that has prepared society to capitulate on these fundamental and basic issues of human identity and biology?
It's clearly ideologically driven and not medically driven. Mm. As you mentioned, some European countries are prohibiting gender surgeries on minors after having permitted them for many years, and they're now seeing the harm, which is why the United States government is exhibiting an unqualified commitment to this ideology. Often we see Europe is 10 to 20 years ahead of where the United States is socially. And so I'm hopeful, actually, we weren't really concerned about Europe, obviously, as Presbyterian Church in America. We were focused on our specific context. But I do think that we can learn from the rest of the world and how they're dealing with this issue in our society.
Yes, it is strange that, you know, American leftists often look to Europe as the model for what they would like to see happening here, whether it's tax reform, whether it's healthcare policies, whether it's gun control. But on this issue, the United States leftists are at least bucking the trend. And as you said, the United States government is often given unqualified endorsement to this, not just for adults, mm-hmm. But to children. And I just cannot understand why has this become the issue. You're right there on Capitol Hill. Do you have any indication as to why there is this fixation on children? Is it just depravity unrestrained?
You know, to be fair to the transgender movement, I really don't think that it is fixated on children. I think most people have the common sense enough to recognize that these are harmful practices, which is why you see so many of these states issuing common sense legislation that's been passed overwhelmingly by their legislative bodies. So I hope that there's some common sense that will come from this generally, that we can all agree that children above all should be protected. And that should be a place that we can all have a starting point from, which is why we've requested meetings with all the people that the PCA wrote this letter to. So we've offered up dates for Dr. Chappell and Fred Greco to come and meet with these leaders of Congress. So we're in conversation with several of them, and hope that some of those come to fruition so that we'll actually be able to make the influence and make the case for the protection of children.
Wonderful. Something our listeners or our viewers can pray that those meetings do take place. Your letter addresses some of your the commission believes, why the PCA, right? You're speaking for the Presbyterian Church in America, as our commission believes that this is prevalent now. Why did you choose to include those data points as opposed to others, right? I think the letter's about 3 pages. You only had so much that you could put in. Why did you decide to say these are the particular issues we're going to focus in on?
You know, it just seems apparent to us. It's clearly something that has come to a head. So we really felt like it was a moment to address this type of issue. All of our commission agreed. We were really leaning heavily on the previous Overture 12 as well. So that's where a lot of some of this information and some of the language came from. We chose not to include footnotes. We can reference the Overture 12 initially, but feel like this is so prevalent in our society, it doesn't need to be footnoted, because there's nothing surprising in this letter. We have all felt and seen the impacts of these type of ideologies on our families and especially on our children.
Yeah, that's a great point that you raise. You know, you've got, I think, 1 college professor, 2 seminary faculty. And, you know, what I learned in out of those research methods classes in undergrad is that if it's in an encyclopedia, you don't have to footnote it, right? General knowledge doesn't have to be footnoted. And what you appeal to here is not highly technical. It's general knowledge. Mm-hmm. Now, you use the expression social contagion. I saw on social media someone giving some pushback to that. What is social contagion?
Again, I think that's just an apparent reality that we have all experienced and seen. Yeah. There are certainly studies that have been referred to that refer to the incredible rise statistically of girls, especially identifying as a different gender from their birth. And some of those studies, it can be debated if they've been retracted or, but we have professors who understand the type of peer pressure that comes on anyone who disagrees with the academy or is outside of their narrow group think. And so we didn't really appeal to that strongly. More, again, just felt reality. We've all experienced and seen the rise in, you know, I have 2 young girls myself, and we see the commercials and the content that is being pushed upon them has so radically changed in the last 5 to 10 years that we have to check and see if the next Paw Patrol episode would include a character that is
transgendered,
non-binary. No, not just animals, but characters as well. But yes, obviously dogs. But yes, the gender issue is being pushed from every angle.
Yeah, it's you know, I can't even. Not that we try to shelter. Now, we do homeschool our children, but we don't try to leave them in a, you know, at the home all of the time. But it's just gotten to the point that we can't even go out anywhere without being confronted by someone who is in desperate need of help and denying his or her biology and reality and the pain that is manifested in that person's appearance, the tortured soul that is there. Now, you say COVID-19 policies may have contributed to this. What led to that conclusion or inference?
Again, just the isolation that we have all seen and experienced have led to this, we would say, the social media policies. We're not trying to take pot shots, but these are such experienced and felt realities that we didn't see a need to footnote these prevalent ideas.
Yes, when I saw that again on social media, that someone was pushing back against, why did they single out COVID-19 policies? I thought, well, because you had kids stuck at home for a year, and their only input was because they, you know, their parents were made to feel afraid of sending them outside into the sun, where viruses go to die. Their only input is from the Zoom of this government school instructor, and then Paw Patrol and the media ramming this down their throat, and of course the anxiety that comes with living in that that terrible way.
I saw just an article this week from Dr. Francis Collins, who said we were too narrow in the way that we made decisions on COVID policies, that we made decisions with the beltway in mind. Again, this is the issue that most people think Washington, D.C. in the news is representative of the United States of America, but that could be furthest from the truth. The inside of the beltway is not representative of the rest of the United States of America. You and I know that. And people who live in the beltway need to be reminded of that. And so Dr. Collins kind of admitted, I think, in a national media piece that their decisions were too narrow and not thoughtful and mindful of the broader population.
Wow, that is remarkable. I would love to link to that article in the in the show notes. You know, one of the issues that has really plagued, I think, the healing generally of this country, and particularly in the area in which I minister, is that people haven't been willing to admit that they were wrong, that these policies may have sounded good in a laboratory, may have sounded reasonable for a hospital, right? If you're, you know, T. David Gordon a few weeks ago was saying, you know, if you're visiting someone who's sick in the hospital, of course you put on a mask. But if, to impose these kind of ideas on healthy people or folks, you know, who may live in a very crowded, densely populated area versus here where I am in Catoosa County, where it's quite quite rural once you get off of Battlefield Parkway. Now, that's that I would, I haven't read the article, but that sounds like a very courageous thing for Dr. Collins to have said.
Well, I'll read a quote. I'll read a quote here.
Yeah,
and he
please.
Is an incredibly godly and humble man. And he was attending McLean Presbyterian Church. He said that publicly. During parts of the COVID pandemic. He obviously lived locally, but he said, yeah, there's collateral damage. Quote, this is a public health mindset. And I think a lot of us involved in trying to make those recommendations had that mindset. And that was really unfortunate. It's another mistake we made. I am thankful for him being one of the only leaders from that time who's actually said, you know what, we did make a mistake.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's... And, you know, that's the kind of thing that he's in a position where he could go to his grave saying, no, we did everything right, and, you know, wouldn't cost him anything. But to make a statement like what he what you just read, that will cost him professionally. And
well, he's retired, but yes.
but yes, I'm sure that there will not be speaking invitations, and there'll be a few Learjet trips that he won't be invited to make because he acknowledged. And, you know, that speaks to his Christian character, I would venture to guess that. To acknowledge that we're wrong and to ask forgiveness. Well, how does the church, kind of changing gears a little bit, how does the church speak truthfully, winsomely, and carefully to this issue, right? Your letter is aimed at the political and judicial leadership, right? This is not a pastoral letter. This is not like our human sexuality report that is something that is more accessible to the every average person. And that's not a criticism, right? I'm not criticizing that you didn't write a pastoral letter, because that's not what you were tasked to do. You provide facts and principles and even some data that you might not in other contexts. So how did you strike a balance realizing that we're not tasked with writing a pastoral letter, but all of us are elders and all of us are pastors, right? Ruling elders are pastors too in our polity. How did you come up with that balance that you want to be pastoral, even though this is a public letter?
Yeah, and so we looked at the precedent that has been set in the PCA in writing letters like this. We certainly looked at the examples in response to Roe v. Wade, for example, the humble petition that was drafted then. And if you read the language, it's really remarkable to look back and see the there was no hope that anything would actually happen. And yet we see the incredible thing that Roe v. Wade has been overturned. And so we wanted to pray with the intentionality that our leaders would hear and truly be transformed by these words. So how can we write a letter in such a way as that is going to speak to them, to the leaders in these three branches of government? And so that's where I hope that I was able to add a little bit of commentary.
Yeah.
And so I was able to provide some good examples and some bad examples of advocacy letters. They're called advocacy letters on Capitol Hill, so that we could be like Paul and the Areopagus and be able to quote their unknown gods and be able to speak to them very clearly about this important topic.
Yes, you bring up the humble petition on abortion, and I think it was the next day after the assembly adopted it that the Supreme Court returned that decision that mattered to the states.
The one back in the 70s, but
yeah. Oh, in the 70s, yes, okay, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So, but that should encourage mm-hmm. us that when the church speaks, when the church implores God's mercy upon the land of our exile, that sometimes he pours out that mercy and it comes through, you know, these five justices on the court.
And if I may, just one of the things too, and looking back at the Westminster Divines and they're sort of speaking to civil magistrates, one of the sort of cases to make is that, okay, well, our government leaders haven't asked the PCA to speak, but I would say that they have. I have conversations with leaders who have asked me, man, it would be incredible for us to be able to have what the Presbyterian Church in America speaks clearly on this topic and issue. And so we have several, you know, PCA members of Congress and so and others who've asked for us to receive this letter as well, because we sent it certainly to the leadership, but also to any member who would be interested in reading it and helping us advocate for our positions.
Yeah, that's a great point, because that fourth paragraph does say if they be required by the civil magistrate to give this advice or right. petition, and they were asking for it. I remember that was one of the criticisms that, well, nobody's asked for this. Why are we speaking to it? But what you're saying with the relationships that you have, and sometimes people will criticize the PCA for not being relational enough, but based on the relationships that you have built and that God has provided to you, you're saying that they are asking for this.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. So for those in the what is often called the LGBTQ+ community, this is their identity. And to question their identity is considered, at least by them, to be violence or an attack on their persons. So how, you know, you deal with a wide variety of people. How do you gain a hearing with people like that or people sympathetic to that point of view without compromising the truth? How do you do your job, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which that's true, but it's also no more their identity than being heterosexual is my identity as well. So, quote, one part of who I am, there's really a diverse understanding of persons in this community. And I think we just start with earlier what you talked about with the Imago Dei, with the reality that every person has infinite value, dignity, and worth. And that's where we try to ground the beginning of our statement. And that's where we think really Overture 12 kind of initially came up short. And Dr. Whitaker, who was on our commission, was really grateful and thankful that we were able to perfect and add to the language to make it so intentionally welcoming, so that we could gain a hearing without compromising the truth that we were trying to speak to.
Great. Yeah. Yes. So how did you go about crafting the letter? Was the labor divided that you take this section, we'll take that, we, you know, did you come up with an outline as a group and then assign it? Just how the nitty gritty of how the sausage is made. How did you do that?
Yeah, we used our background and experiences to craft a letter in a unified way. And we certainly reached out to previous committees that had written letters, including some individuals who were on the Human Sexuality Report. Obviously, we weren't writing quite the extensive letter that they did, but we could learn from their process. And one of the things that we did here is you don't want a Frankenstein letter, because it really does sound like it's from 10 different voices. And so
right.
we know the letters, the sections of the Human Sexuality Report that were written by Tim Keller. We know the sections of the Human Sexuality Report that were written by Kevin DeYoung as primary authors. And so we took some of those learnings from them and certainly did outline together. We looked at previous letters, what had been included in previous letters, what the Human Sexuality Report said about transgenderism, any sort of them speaking on this topic, which was actually quite narrow and limited, I think. But we leaned heavily on the original overture and our own experiences and readings to really come up with the tone and the substance and the content of the letter that we ultimately did. And we're all very united in its sort of drafting. Sometimes it was drafting behind the scenes and a couple people coming in to edit it. Sometimes we met and we really did some live drafting, and this sentence, I don't quite like it. How could we say it different? And that was one of my favorite lines, that rejecting biological sex is ultimately attempting the impossible. That was a line that was sort of drafted live when we were all just kind of working together. So there were a couple different ways that we drafted the letter, but ultimately using our background and experiences to craft this letter in a very unified way.
Yes, yes. It doesn't read like a Frankenstein letter.
One of the things that has been neat as well, and I won't name these groups, but there's been a couple different groups and other like-minded denominations that have reached out to us that are crafting similar statements and want to do something very similar to what the PCA has done, and have commended what we have written. And so I'm encouraged by that and hopeful that even by the assembly that there will be some more letters that will be published along the same lines.
Well, great. Great. Well, is there anything left for the members, the churches, the presbyteries in the Presbyterian Church in America to do in this regard? Or, you know, this letter's been sent. That's it. What else is left to do?
Well, the stated clerk has sent this to you by both snail mail and email to the leaders that we addressed. But then all of the stated clerks of presbyteries have been given sort of language, cover letter language to send to their local context as well. And we want to be thoughtful and mindful that there are already states in Idaho and other places that have passed legislation that are already in alignment with this letter. And so we want to commend those legislatures because we don't want to sound tone deaf and ask them to do something that they've already done. And so in some ways, we've encouraged them to commend and encourage their local context, and others asking them to send this to their local bodies. And obviously some presbyteries have multiple states and even multiple nations. And so I think that is up to them and their original context to send to their local bodies, but we have encouraged them. The letter is in your hands. It's in the hands of our local churches and presbyteries, and so they have the full authority and ability to be able to send this to their local context in whatever way is appropriate.
So there would be nothing preventing a session, for example, another church court, from sending this to the city council or the county board of commissioners in their local context, or a presbytery, as you say, sending it to the state capitol.
Yeah, I mean, this is the denomination has spoken on this topic and issue. So as a session is representative of that local denomination, I would think that it would make sense and be appropriate to send to those local bodies.
Great. Yes. So that would certainly be something that we don't need to think that all the work is done. Now all we need to do is pray, as if it's all we need to do, but continue to speak the truth and to petition our local and regional officials. Mm-hmm. I know there's an overture. I don't know if it's on the stated clerk's website, but I know it passed because I was there from Tennessee Valley Presbytery, asking that this petition be translated into French and sent to Canada. So did you have any discussions about the other nations served by the PCA as you were crafting this letter, and how you might try to be inclusive of their own concerns?
We certainly had Canada in view. Some of the lines that we chose did include, for example, the United States and Canada in the language, but it was beyond our scope and what was given to us by the General Assembly. So in our polity, we weren't quite sure how to do that ourselves, but it would make sense, you know, for what Tennessee Valley Presbytery did to send to the Assembly so that it can be translated into French. It's been a long time since I studied French at Covenant College, so we didn't quite think we were the right group to be able to do that sort of thing, but would commend anyone who would want to do that.
Yes, yes. And again, I appreciate the commission's care in sticking only to the mandate given to her by the Assembly. Well, have any of the commission members received pushback? I know one of them at least works for a state university in Michigan, which is not a state that is necessarily friendly to the truth. Mm-hmm. Their governor is certainly very hostile to natural law. Mm-hmm. Have any commissioners, you know, received threats or disciplinary letters or reprimands professionally or personally for that
matter? It's a great question. As far as I know, no, but certainly pray for us and especially those ruling elders who are more in the public sphere. Jim is certainly one who I've been thinking about. I don't know if he has tenure. I imagine that he does, and because he's been so confident in speaking on this topic, and he's such a faithful ruling elder in that church there in Ann Arbor, and such an active participant in his presbytery and General Assembly. So none that I'm aware of, but certainly pray, continue to pray for us. Thank you.
Yes, yes. And that's, you know, on this issue, people, institutions often will pull out all the stops, that this is in our moment, the third rail, that you touch this, it doesn't matter how tenured you are, how essential you are as a worker or an expert, that this can get you fired very quickly.
I did have to certainly let a few folks in Congress know who are PCA, who may not know about this letter, just for their own awareness. Politically, just so that they know what the church has said on this sort of topic. So it's relevant, I think, not just for those of us on the commission, but even others who might be connected with and affiliated with a denomination that's able to speak. So we hope humbly, but winsomely about this important topic.
Yes, and that's a great point that you raise, that it's not just the members of the commission, it's anyone associated with the PCA that will now be labeled and perhaps even targeted by those who wish to do violence. And there was that concern at General Assembly, I recall. Stated Clerk Chapel reminded at the Committee of Commissioners briefing meetings and at perhaps at other times, but that's the one that I remember particularly, that there have been specific threats made against the Assembly meeting there in Memphis. And just be aware, and let the professionals do their job, and there was a more visible police presence. Well, as we kind of bring it in, what are your hopes, your aspirations, your goals for the Presbyterian Church in America as we look back on 50 years and look forward, God willing, to 50 years and many more if the Lord tarries?
It's a beautiful question, and I think I'll just connect it to this letter and our commission. But I don't want us to get pulled into every issue. And so I would just commend us as we are thinking about what does this look like. Our goal as pastors and teachers is to continue to be ministers of the word. And we hope that cases extraordinary are limited, and that they are extraordinary and not more ordinary in these times. But for the PCA at large, I'm a part of the Ministry of North America. MTS is a part of M&A, and I'm excited as I get to talk with people here in the Washington, D.C. area about the growth of our denomination. As the mainline denominations around us are in steep decline, I'm encouraged by our incredible aspirations and goals to plant 1,000 churches and to continue to see institutions solidified and encouraged like Covenant College, my alma mater. We want to see these beacons of hope continue to grow because increasingly they will become and look more starkly different from the culture. And I personally don't think that that is a bad thing, because I think as we separate more from what the culture is and from what the church truly is and representative of, then we will begin to see, hopefully, God willing, less hypocrisy and more beauty of actually looking like the bride of Christ herself.
Mm, well said. Now, ministry to state, how can people find you, get information about the work that you're doing there?
Yeah, ministrytostate.org is our website, and we're 20 years old this year. Our founder, Chuck Garriott, was a pastor in Oklahoma City and started his ministry just after the Oklahoma City bombing. In response, was part of the clergy response there and providing care, spiritual care for people, government workers who are affected, and really saw that this could be a national ministry. And so we have 10 different state capital ministers and five staff who are in Washington, D.C., and continuing to grow our team. So as you think about, and as people want to come and visit Washington, D.C., or send their young people, we have an intern ministry during the summer called Commons. It's like RUF during the summer for anyone who comes to Capitol Hill to do an internship. There's thousands of them who come, and we meet in our house, our home, every week on Capitol Hill and provide dinner and fellowship for them. So in whatever way we can connect with and encourage people, I would say there are many good and godly leaders in Washington, D.C., and we should continue to pray for those who are in high positions who are far off from him, because it can be a lonely place. As often as you see folks on TV, we can feel disconnected from them, but they are within our reach. Literally, they are within the reach of our local churches here in Potomac Presbytery, and my physical reach is just walking around the halls of Congress. So pray for us to continue to reach those types of men and women.
And are you one of the people that need to raise support? So if people wanted to support your, is that, would that be information on the Ministry to State website?
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. Yeah, Ministry to State, we are all support raising, fundraisers, missionaries to Washington, D.C. So Ministry to North America has all of our contact information if folks wanted to give online.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you so much for your work on this commission and your ministry in the halls of Congress, Nathan.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks for joining the conversation on the Westminster Standard, which is the podcast of Jude 3. For additional resources or to make a donation, visit our website, jude3pca.org. And please come back next week as I am joined by Teaching Elder Stephen O'Neill to discuss the decision of the Standing Judicial Commission regarding a reference from the General Assembly about a woman posing as a preacher during a worship service at Trinity Presbyterian Church in Rye, New York. We'll reflect on the reasoning of the SJC and what the Assembly's Judicial Commission has directed Metro New York Presbytery to do in order to resolve this disturbing action in hopes of restoring peace and unity in the Presbyterian Church in America. I'll talk to you then.